Welcome to the Capitol Beach. My name is Derek Brockbank. I'm the Executive Director of Coastal States Organization. I am the host for the Capitol Beach. I am very excited to be doing a podcast today to talk with Paul Scholes, who is the Deputy Assistant Administrator for the National Ocean Service at NOAA. And I know we often talk about wonky things on this show, and we might be setting a new wonkiness record because we are talking about strategic plan. NOS recently put out a strategic plan, and so I'm talking to Paul about what it includes, and then hoping to hear from him a little bit more about why a strategic plan at an agency or at a service within an agency or administration, because NOAA is an administration, why it's important. How does this actually impact people on the ground? So really looking forward to hearing Paul make that connection from, you know, strategic theory, strategic vision to on the ground coastal practice. So really looking forward to it. And before we begin, let's hear from our sponsors.
Support for the American Shoreline Podcast Network and Coastal News Today comes from Geodynamics, an NV5 company. Geodynamics' team of specialists provide accurate surveys of complex coastal environments around the world using the latest technology in marine geology, coastal science, and remote sensing. With customized vessels and sensor configurations, Geodynamics delivers meticulous data products to answer their clients' toughest questions. Visit nv5geospatial.com or geodynamicsgroup.com to learn more about Geodynamics and their solutions that improve lives. And from the Coastal Zone Foundation. The Certified Coastal Practitioner Program from the Coastal Zone Foundation offers courses covering 11 different subject areas, including coastal engineering, ecology, geology, project management, and more. The CCP program emphasizes a multidisciplinary approach to coastal zone management, setting you apart from the competition and demonstrating your commitment to best practices and a code of ethics in your field. With modules available online or as live short courses, the CCP program is accessible to coastal professionals at all stages of their careers. Learn more at coastalzonefoundation.org. And don't forget, subscribe to the CNT Daily Blast newsletter for the latest news and updates from around the American shoreline. Want to support our work? Learn more about sponsorship packages at coastalnewstoday.com/advertising.
Okay, Paul, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Well, I don't want to feel bad starting by aging you, but you've worked at NOAA for a while. So why don't you tell us a bit about yourself? I can't believe we haven't had you on one of these podcasts before. Tell us about what you've done at NOAA and what you do now.
Yeah, thank you. I joined NOAA back in 1994. NOAA was establishing a new center in Charleston, South Carolina, which became known as the Coastal Services Center. And I was originally hired into NOAA to be a training specialist because I had been doing participant training programs for foreign nationals up to that point, and came in, but I was the last person to go through the training and didn't spend any time doing the training with this new center, but really kind of started doing the customer outreach and connections with the coastal management community that we were working to serve. And so I spent 23 years at CSC down in Charleston, and in its current incarnation, which was a combination of CSC and the Office for Ocean and Coastal Resources Management, now known as the Office for Coastal Management. But over those 23 years, I did four different details into other parts of the agency and outside the agencies. So I worked at FEMA, helping them with their federal flood mapping program and developing the new program for that. I worked in the Weather Service, both at FEMA and the Weather Service. It was 6 months helping them with their climate services division and implementation. And I worked in OAR for a while, helping when NOAA was trying to establish a climate services line office. I was over there for a while. So I've bounced around the agency. I've been around quite some time. I went from there and actually became the CFO, CAO for the National Ocean Service in 2018, which I did for a couple years and then was acting as their Deputy Assistant Administrator before I was hired into the permanent position as Deputy Assistant Administrator. And I'm coming up on 2 years in the permanent position now.
That's a fascinating history, and both I love the fact that you've been with NOAA for so long, but have also had details across NOAA and even at other agencies. You mentioned FEMA, which gives you sort of a real insider's perspective on how coastal coastal government work, coastal government processes work. So in your nearly 30 years at NOAA, you must have seen it evolve. You mentioned the change from the Coastal Resources Center to what's now sort of a multidisciplinary, but an Office for Coastal Management. What has interested you the most in what you've seen over how NOAA has evolved? What are the biggest changes? What's excited you about how NOAA has evolved over the past 30 years?
So the interesting thing about NOAA is, and most of NOAA and the people in NOAA are very passionate about the mission and the activities. And what's kept me interested is the National Ocean Service has such a broad set of missions and activities. But I can say over that almost 30 years, I've been through 13 different AA-DAA combinations in NOS. And I didn't count up before this call, but I've been through quite a few administration transitions. And what has been the most exciting is the transition to this administration, where not only do the administrator and all the policy team that are part of NOAA care about the NOS mission and activity, but the Department of Commerce has a secretary that came from Rhode Island who actually not only cares about the issues that the National Ocean Service is working on, but actually has an opinion about the things that we should be doing and focusing on. And it's reflected in the department's strategic plan and the activities and the National Ocean Service's strategic plan, as well as the NOAA plan.
Yeah, that's cool. The Secretary of Commerce comes from the ocean state, so would not naturally have an interest in the Ocean Service.
Exactly.
Okay, think big picture. We're going to get into the NOS strategic plan at a bit more detail, but really just sort of at a high level, what is happening at NOAA right now that excites you or inspires you the most?
Well, I think all the interest and the effort that's going on around trying to make all of the climate-related services, products and services that NOAA produces available and accessible across the nation and help work with the communities across the nation to focus on the issues that are of prime importance in terms of, in particular, in terms of how they maintain their resilience to all of these increasing challenges and extreme events, as well as man-made events in the form of chemical and oil contaminants and spills. There's just a lot of opportunity with that. There's a lot of opportunity that the bipartisan infrastructure law and the Infrastructure Reduction Act have provided some access to resources have never been seen to help focus on community level projects and activities, particularly in the coastal environments that allows us to kind of advance the ball in ways that we have never had an opportunity to do before.
Yeah, great answer. I think we've had a number of shows, and our listeners are probably pretty aware of what I've sort of called the summer of money with all the different BIL and IRA, Bipartisan Infrastructure Law and Inflation Reduction Act funds coming out. But I really love that first answer with the climate services and climate tools. I think the explosion of data and tools that have become available in the past 5 or 10 years of how to plan for climate change and adapt to climate change and reduce your emissions and all that sort of stuff has just been incredible. NOAA's been leading the way on that. Certainly other agencies have. It feels like that's sort of a pointed moment right now. Recently, my organization has participated in conversations with the U.S. Global GCRP, the Global Climate Research Program, which is an interagency effort. The National Academies of Sciences are looking at how to integrate and coordinate across the various climate services, but NOAA is going to be front and center in anything related to that. So glad you brought that up. Okay, we mentioned your title. You're the Deputy Assistant Administrator. For those of you that are not in the DC parlance, that's number two on the org chart. So working closely with Nicole LaBeouf, who's been a regular on this show, for the National Ocean Service. You mentioned that National Ocean Service has a pretty broad portfolio. Can you explain what NOS does, sort of what it covers, and then maybe a little bit of how it interacts with NOAA's other services?
Sure, happy to do that. So the National Ocean Service really has kind of two primary threads, if you will. And we actually have two deputy assistant administrators. I am over the Ocean Sciences and Coastal Zone Management or part of the portfolio. So that's all of the things focused on natural resource management, trying to help with the science portfolio, make available all of the different kinds of environmental information that we may be doing, and to connect with the local communities, helping the nation's communities understand how they can adapt and address things as it relates to the climate change, particularly as it relates to sea level rise, but also many other components of that. The other half of the National Ocean Service portfolio, if you will, is the navigation, observation, and positioning side of our portfolio. And Rachel Dempsey is the DAA over that part. And that is really the side of the organization that is involved in the what I'll call foundational data sets necessary for the whole infrastructure for ocean observing, for navigation, for positioning, land subsidence, movement of land, which has an impact on, you know, where the water levels are actually hitting on the land, et cetera. And so we cover, you know, quite the gambit of activities across all that. Some parts of the navigation obs and portfolio mission go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson days. The Coast Survey was helping do the survey of the coast and started the process of doing electronic navigational charts. And the last thing that I'll say is, like, we work within NOS, we have what we call our networked partner programs. The Coastal States Organization happens to be one of them. There are a number of them, but almost all of our mission areas have a partner network that we work with and through in order to implement and the activities working, whether that's through the coastal management community, the local and state governments. As you mentioned, there are a lot of other federal agencies that are contributing pieces to the puzzle, the USGS, FEMA, Army Corps of Engineers, NASA. They're all involved in a lot of these activities, as well as a whole host of academic institutions that are helping us plug gaps in knowledge and information as it relates to the scientific inquiries that we're doing to try to advance the various parts of our portfolio.
Excellent. Thank you. That was a really comprehensive overview of a broad service area. And thank you for flagging the observation and data set folks. We could probably should have a whole podcast on that, but we're mostly going to skip over that for today. So the reason we have you here is the National Ocean Service recently put out a 5-year strategic plan. It's a full 45-page strategic plan. It starts with values and principles and authorities, what allows you to do this, and then is followed by 4 high-level goals and dozens of objectives. We're not obviously going to have time to get into, you know, every single one, but was hoping that maybe before we get into some, you could give us a high-level overview. Why now? And what would be the single biggest take-home message from this strategic plan?
Sure. Thank you. So first off, you know, you paused a bit as you were saying 45-page plan, and you did at the onset of this podcast ask to make connections to people on the ground and the activities. The reason our plan is as long as it is because we don't want this to just be a plan for the shelf, a communications document, and a tool for for getting the message out about what the NOS, National Ocean Service, is about, but it is a guidepost. And so it includes things that, like you mentioned, the values that we hold dear, our staff and organization hold dear, the principles that we operate under. You mentioned the authorities. We have 26 different legal authorities that we operate across this broad spectrum. The plan itself includes also, I don't know how many exactly, but quite a few strategies that are actually getting to the specifics and details of the things that are getting implemented, and measures for success in terms of identifying how we plan to hold ourselves accountable for making progress on these activities. And then lastly, there's quite a few examples of activities that are done as pullouts and so forth to give people kind of more specific ideas on what we're working on. But at a high level, the biggest take-home message here is that right now there's an incredible set of challenges, when you consider the hazards, the vulnerabilities in our ocean and along our coasts and the Great Lakes, including coastal flooding, sea level rise, coastal hazards, stress on coastal habitats and ecosystems. This is an extremely complicated set of challenges, and we have a really pretty broad, diverse set of expertise that we bring to bear on these activities, from resilience to coastal planning to nature-based solutions. There's also the whole wealth of ocean and coastal data and observations. This is all really complex, and we're trying to bring all that to bear on these big problems that the nation is facing. And so in the course of this, and we did reach out to our customers and our partners, the Coastal States Organization also participated in the dialogue as we were building this plan. The net result is boiling it down into four strategic priorities that are critical, we believe are critical to prepare our organization and for our organization to move forward in order to serve the nation's growing needs in these areas. The top one is the increase, and I've already mentioned it in a number of different ways, increasing U.S. coastal resilience. And this is really focusing on trying to build resilience across all communities in the U.S., and particularly in coastal area, but all communities, to help them prepare for environmental threats and bring the whole suite of things to bear on that in place-based partnerships and deal with the unique needs in individual communities by bringing a customer service-oriented line office to the conversation. Secondly, make equity central to our mission. We have two different ways of thinking about equitability. And one is the equity of how we develop and provide our data, products, and services to the public and to the nation and to the communities. And the other is internally. How can we build and sustain a diverse, equitable, and inclusive organization so that we can actually be the most effective that we can be? So we are working toward making it part of everything that we do. Third is accelerating the growth of the ocean enterprise and the blue economy. And this is really trying to take all of those foundational things that we talked about, observations, positioning, all of that, supply, and developing, working with our various partners and activities to develop technology that can help generate additional ocean data and work with the existing streams of ocean data that we have to develop or deliver societal benefit and business benefits so that we can hopefully build a new enterprise around the blue economy. This is working with businesses and government, academia, and other organizations across all of that. Anyway, to try to be an ocean and coastal research leader in this area of observing technologies and help the ocean enterprise develop more fully. The fourth goal area is conserve, restore, connect healthy coastal and marine ecosystems. And this is where our role serving as a steward of the ocean and coasts of the nation comes into play. So everything from the coastal zone management programs nationwide, the National Estuarine Research Reserve System, the coral reef jurisdictions, as well as the responsibility we have for ocean management through the National Marine Sanctuary Program, kind of all falls into this category. And we're recognizing that the stewardship of the ocean and coast is a shared responsibility. So this is all done in partnership with other governments and engaging with the public and increasingly with tribal nations on many of these issues as we move forward. And then the last area that I'll mention as it relates to the strategic plan is we have a set of enterprise objectives, which are in four different areas that are really to address the fact that these are ambitious goals. And in order to be consistent in doing the work that we're doing more effectively, faster, and efficiently, We've kind of put these out there that we need to focus on over the next 5 years. One is building our workforce, and I've already talked about the diversity side of that, but also building and continuing to build the existing workforce skills and capabilities. Modernizing our IT infrastructure, as everyone is aware, that is continually changing and evolving. Updating our facilities and infrastructure, because we have quite a broad set of facilities and infrastructure around the nation of the small program as well as facilities. And then basically improving our operational efficiency and the impact that we can have on the ground as we're working with and through all these partner networks that we collaborate with.
Excellent. Thank you, Paul. That was a really good overview. So I'm just going to repeat it, the high points. So first was increasing coastal resilience in the U.S. Second is making equity central to the mission. Third is accelerating the growth of the ocean enterprise and the blue economy. And then fourth was conserving, restoring, and connecting healthy coastal and marine ecosystems. And then the fifth, the enterprise objective, really involves how to create NOAA as a more, you know, highly functional, better, more efficient organization. So really good. You know, we could spend probably an hour or more on any of these, but wanted to look into a couple specifically and sort of connecting back to the what I brought up at the start, which is how does this translate to on the ground? Wanted to look at the make equity central to the mission area, and the idea of how NOAA is pushing to support equity within its program. So really appreciate that equity is part of what NOAA is thinking about internally, how to make its staff diverse and how to create equity within the workforce at NOAA. But let's take a look at the external push. So how does NOAA actually go about making equity central to the mission over the next 5 years? How are you pushing this into the work that you're doing on the ground or with partners or with communities?
Yeah, thank you for that. So we recognize that historically underserved populations, they've been underrepresented in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics fields, and that entire segments of our society have been or felt marginalized, underserved, or underrepresented in these efforts in terms of preparing for, responding to, recovering from, or adapting to weather and climate-related impacts, even though they may be at greater risk because there may be in low-lying areas. So if you take the theoretical Gulf Coast community that's an underserved community that may be, you pick your state, there are examples in many of the states. The biggest example, so one of the things that we've been doing, and you made this question about NOAA, I'm going to focus my response mostly on NOS, but this part of my answer does talk about all of NOAA, because what we have been doing across NOAA is doing assessments of some of our products, services, and data in terms of whether they're actually delivering to the communities we're trying to serve the information that we're trying and the skills and necessary to interpret that information that we're trying to do. And so our Sea Level Rise viewer was one of the things that was evaluated during one of these assessments. And that viewer displays for communities, and our staff, as well as the state coastal management staff, take this into public meetings and display what would happen in their community if they had a meter or 3 feet rise in sea level or a foot rise in sea level. And they can see visually where what parts of the community would flood in that and where it would be. Like, there's even parts of it that bring it into a street level where you can see where the water level would be on the street. You can see where the stores would be getting flooded or the cars would be getting flooded because of the visual impacts and the tools. Well, what happened when we did that equity assessment was the low-lying areas in one region, what was part of the assessment, I believe in Texas, but it might have been Louisiana because they both have the issue. The low-lying areas turned out to be where the HUD had done quite a bit of building of their low-income housing. And a lot of those areas, communities, didn't have public transit that was getting to and from them, and it didn't have a lot of people that had vehicles themselves. And so the reason for displaying the visual image of where the flood is going to impact, so you can help people know when they need to evacuate because a storm is coming or because of the flooding. And in this particular case, those people didn't have a way to get away from there, even if they could determine that they would actually were going to be flooding. And so, you know, the evacuation process meant that then the community had to be aware, all right, we got to think about whether we get buses here. This is how we, our data and information feeds into community level decision making. And our desire to improve and enhance this as the sea level is rising so that we can improve those products. But that particular product was also not getting into a form that that community could use. The low-income minority portion of that community was actually not getting access to that information. So that's since changed the way we go about the needs assessment as we're doing that kind of product development, decision support tool development and activity. So that's a specific example that relates to that that particular type of assessment product that we did. We have designs to do additional kind of work in that area in terms of equity and trying to do additional assessments as we get into new product development, as we have long term. Our desire is with new product development and new tool development or new data stream development that we be thinking about it as we're doing the development of the new product or service, and yet still continue to do assessments of existing product lines to ensure that those things are hitting the right audience at the right time with the right information to be able to help them. Because without that, we're just kind of pumping things out and pushing them out, but they're not necessarily being connected to the community in the right way. The other part of it is actually part of having people on the ground. We have people for many of our program offices that are located around the United States. The geodetic advisors actually have people on the ground in many states, including the inland states, and they're doing a lot of work with communities and with people to understand how they, what they understand is happening with their, whether it's land movement or water levels and whatnot, and they're getting out and talking with those communities. Sea Grant has people that get out and work in the communities, the extension agents. So NOAA-wide, there's kind of a broad swath of things, but we have a major push to try to focus on understanding at the grassroots levels. And that goes to some of the work that we've been doing with some of the tribal nations as well, because we haven't traditionally served a lot of their particular needs and functions, but have been making a push to do that more and more as we move forward. The last I'll mention, which is a program that is specifically focused on investments, and it's in particular as a result of the Infrastructure Reduction Act, are trying to focus on equitable service delivery for community resilience and climate resilience in particular. We have a funding opportunity notice that's out there right now that has a number of tracks, and it has one of the program priorities is explicitly to focus on underrepresented or disadvantaged communities, be they tribal or other disadvantaged and underrepresented communities, and those communities that may not have been yet had done much as it relates to adaptation and development for to prepare for what's changing with the sea level and what's changing with the climate. There is no matching requirement because many of these communities would not be able to come up with a non-federal match for these. We've done a whole host of things as this program has been rolling out. We extended the application window because it takes longer for communities that may not have had access or developed these kinds of things to figure it all out. We've also been doing both kind of pre-award training and helping them. We developed a template to help them understand, you know, what the most effective way is to put together a letter of intent or proposal package. We've actually done technical assistance on the ground and we'll continue to do that to help them with the application development itself, as well as providing technical assistance as the projects are approved, which will be occurring during fiscal year 24, ongoing technical assistance so they will be able to implement the projects and operate them effectively as they move forward. We've also produced these materials, the outreach materials for these, and hosted live webinars, both in English and in Spanish, including an introductory video so that we can try to reach a broader, even broader swath of the community than we have otherwise. So These are just some specific examples of ways that we're trying to move forward with activities that we think are critically important for the nation, but in a way that actually makes it possible for disadvantaged communities to actually benefit from them as well directly.
Oh man, Paul, you got me scribbling down notes as fast as I could keep up with you. That was a lot there. So if I can sort of maybe recap and see if I'm getting this correct, I think you started by talking a little bit about developing information that is applicable to underserved communities, frontline communities, but not just developing the information, making sure that the tools and the way in which that information is conveyed is equitable, right? So you can have talk about sea level rise viewer. You talked about making sure that that's getting out there. You talked about both developing products and developing that information from the get-go in ways that look at equity and think about equity, but also for existing products or as you are developing products, doing sort of interim assessments to make sure that they are continuing to maintain that level of equity, which I think is great. You talked about the sort of the service delivery, making sure that your grants and efforts to provide on the ground funding, those are targeted towards or specifically available to underserved communities, but also looking in terms of your own sort of internal processes and metrics to ensure that it is in fact accessible. So, you know, saying, hey, this is a grant for an underserved community, but you have to put together a, 57 page grant report and, application with no funding is not really that helpful. So going through and developing some of those changes. So I'm sure there's other stuff, but those all seem like really good organizational ways to ensure equity, to push out, to make sure that underserved communities not just have a seat at the table, but are actually at the table. I think there's a difference between, providing that seat and making sure that they're there and participating. And it sounds like you're really trying to make that.
Exactly. And we could actually spend 2 hours. And I mean, we have hundreds of examples of things that we're trying to do on the ground, but just trying to give you some representative examples.
Yep, that's really good. We'll certainly appreciate the efforts that NOAA has taken and NOS has taken to move that forward. Still a lot of work to do, but really nice to see that as embedded as a sort of core, one of the four core priority areas. And if you read the plan, it certainly seems like it's sort of embedded within the other priority areas too. Let's pivot. First thing you brought up was the sea level rise viewer. And one thing I wanted to bring up with you, and this I think probably connects mostly to the increase in coastal resilience, although there may be aspects of all of it, is, a little over a year ago, NOAA put out, and I think NOS was one of the lead players or lead participants in this, but put out a updated report on sea level rise. It was sobering, right? It created a much more precise expectations or predictions for how sea level rise was going to be affecting communities all across the country. And so we are starting to have a better understanding of what coastal areas will look like in 20, 50, 100 years. So my question is, when you're looking at, I know we are seeing some of the impacts of sea level rise now, but the sort of the biggest ones are going to be in that 2050, 100 year timeframe, and certainly even beyond that. And this strategic plan is only for 5 years. So how are you, what policies or what aspects of this plan were you putting together to say what you can do in 5 years that will make the longer term coastal community better? Is that something you can sort of explain?
Happy to talk about that. But let me just start though, that this was an interagency report. This was not a NOAA report. And that's a critically important issue because on the issue of sea level and sea level rise and climate change as it relates to sea level, there was an 8-agency interagency report and has been very well received. And it included also, what NOAA did to add to that was NOAA and Sea Grant, NOS and Sea Grant put together a guide for communities to use in how they could apply what the interagency report had in it, specifically to their community, because the regional specifics could be a little bit complicated to deal with.
Thank you for bringing that up, Paul. Yeah, no, I actually remember complaining 5 and 10 years ago that, Army Corps said this and NOAA said this and on sea level rise. And so it was
exactly.
Really great to have a...
Well, and NASA, yeah. And I could tell you a bit what the good thing about doing that report together, and it's one of the reasons I always start by saying it was interagency, is that work has continued, and we are now getting to the place where we are probably going to be unrolling like a kind of one site for all of the government in terms of sea level and sea level rise related information that will be unrolling during this fiscal year. But that's some of the work that we are doing that you asked about, that as part of the increasing resilience that we're doing this year, and we will continue to do with all this interagency group to try to make accessible all of the data and information the federal government has around these topics, as well as all of the products and the services and the decision support that the federal government can have. So that on that particular area, we are investing pretty heavily in some rather senior positions to actually kind of help with that, so we can make sure that NOS is plugging into that, but the Interagency Forum is also all plugging in a way that actually helps on the ground in communities as well. As we talked about, that a lot of this does most heavily relate to coastal resilience, but it is also important in all of the areas of our plan, as we talked about equity and the some of the lower income communities are the ones that have been underserved that may not be as prepared even as the others. And I think it's worth mentioning that the next 30 years are likely going to see the same level of sea level rise that we've seen in the last 100. So if you in the next 5 years, it will be noticeable in many of these communities. I mean, it is impacting places like the Norfolk area, and it has. You've seen a lot about sunny day flooding because changes in sea level and salinity as a result of climate change are influencing how close to shore the Gulf Stream comes, which influences how much water is getting pushed up in that region, which is what's influencing sunny day, you know, what the water level is on sunny days. So sea level rise is impacted by a lot more than just extreme events and some of these other activities. And some of the things that we're trying to do is connect some of these other stressors to the products and services that we're doing in a way that can actually help with both the short term kind of emergency response as well as longer term building and infrastructure siting. We've been leading the push within NOAA to evaluate the overall facility infrastructure for NOAA. We have close to 1,000, you know, structures around the nation, buildings, you know, labs, centers, et cetera, some of which are in very low-lying areas. And so we are trying to lead by example and push to redevelop in our infrastructure, both in terms of adaption as well as mitigation measures that we can do. But on the ground with partners, we are working a lot with State CZM, the National Estuarine Research Reserve, Sea Grant Extension, the IUS Regional Associations, to connect those things that we're doing with information coming out from this sea level rise report. In the last recently, the newest National Climate Assessment came out, and if you've been tracking the fifth one, and if you've been tracking that over the five climate assessments, the sea level rise in particular has been tracking with the highest level projection for what it could do over the last five cycles for doing that. And I forget what frequency they're done on, but it's been an extended period. So a lot of what we're trying to do that relates to kind of moving forward, you know, is connect existing systems and things. Some we have a substantial amount of work with things that relate to sea level rise, but they're not necessarily called sea level rise. So things like, and I talked about the Sea Level Rise Viewer, which is helping communities do planning in a different way. But we have the whole nationwide water level observing system. What we're having to do and evaluate as we refresh that system is we are having more and more frequent larger storms. So we are having to move away from what are almost mobile stations that we can put in place, but they're not very resilient to storms. We're having to move from doing that level of a build out of a station to hardening them, as we have done in many areas of the Gulf in the Southeast over the years. That's a much more expensive, we're talking 3 to 4 orders of magnitude more expensive proposition to do for every individual station. So that's critical to knowing what the tides and water levels are doing at any given time. Vertical land motion is another one, and it's one that we do in partnership with NASA, but it's another one that people don't really think about. Think about Alaska and the amount of ice melting that is occurring as a result of slight temperature shifts. And what is happening from that is what's called geostatic rebound, where the land is actually bouncing up because the weight of the ice is getting less. And the net effect of it is it makes it look like the sea level is going down. So that has certain kinds of effects if you have a port or a harbor in an activity, or if you have navigation going on through the area. So that's the opposite of what people think about when they think about sea level, and they tend to think about sea level rise. That one's bouncing the other way. And then we have as many examples as we could use about on vertical land motion as a result of sediments getting transported out of the way. Louisiana is a good example of that, where because the sediment source down the Mississippi is going to one particular area, it's not going back and forth, and you're seeing what is effectively looking like subsidence of the land, when in reality it's just that the land is not getting new sources of sediment coming in. So that's another example. The last example I would give actually relates to the National Spatial Reference System, because land is constantly moving. If you think about islands, you think about Puerto Rico or Hawaii or the U.S. Virgin Islands, they're constantly moving up, down, and back and forth. You have to always have a reference system to be able to map the things that are going on in that island. If they're moving, and these are in some of the islands, they're on scales that are fairly fast. If you're not keeping that reference system, which is a geodetic control reference system for the nation, up to date, then you have things like when you have an airport that's right on the edge of the land, and you're using a geo-referencing system, it may not actually be exactly where the map is placing it if you're not updating that reference system on a regular basis and being consistent with that. So overall, we're just trying to look at helping lead across the whole range of things that we might do. And because of all of our partnerships with the states and the local communities, other parts of NOAA might be able to do to help bring, and in the interagency forum as well, as I mentioned, so that the communities can actually be more prepared and more aware of what the implications are over the next 5 to 20 to 30 to more years as it goes forward.
Yeah, super helpful. And I like that you extended the sea level rise to also address just change in the coastal and ocean space. And while that change will, amplify over the coming years, there are going to be in the next 5 years real impacts. And the policies and coordination that's happening now will ensure that we're not too far behind as we move forward. So, Paul, this has been just a terrific conversation. I really appreciate all the information. I feel like I've learned a lot. I knew a lot about NOAA, but I'm continue to learn more. Anything else that you wished I would have asked, or anything else you want to share about the strategic plan at this point?
Not specific to the strategic plan. I mentioned briefly about the bipartisan infrastructure law and the IRA funding. Just for frame of reference, so the annual appropriation for the National Ocean Service is around $680 million. We got $1.5 billion in bipartisan infrastructure law funding and $1.1 billion in Infrastructure Reduction Act funding. Now, those are both spread over 4 and 5 years, but it is a significant resource that is providing us with a significant opportunity for the nation. We have, and it includes a wide range of activities, some of which we've talked about, some of which we haven't. Marine debris is a big focus of portions of that, as well as our partnership with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation for some of the funds that we're moving forward to try to do on the ground activities. We are currently looking at how we learn from those projects that are going to be very local scale projects, a really extensive amount of local scale projects, but how we learn from them fast enough to have the things that we're learning in the first year start impacting the things that we're doing in years 2 through 5 fast enough to improve things as we move through this process. It's a great opportunity. It is extremely challenging. And even though the dollar numbers sound rather huge, what we are seeing is the demand signal from the states and communities is a couple of order of magnitudes larger than even these dollar amounts, because everybody is aware that these are pressing problems and challenges that we need to be prepared for. And there's a lot of work to be done.
Thanks for bringing that up. I don't think we can bring that up enough. I mean, I know there's so many different funding opportunities that were coming out this summer and continue to come out. And you mentioned some of the equitable grants that are going to be coming out. But I think that, you know, the big one was the Climate Resilience Regional Challenge. It was a $575 million opportunity. I mean, when was the last time NOAA had won opportunity for $575 million. And we found out after the LOIs had been submitted and some invited back that I think there were something close to $16 billion in applications. So, I mean, 30 orders of magnitude greater than what was available for the biggest opportunity that NOAA had ever put out. So hopefully Congress is listening to this, and the lessons they're learning is we need to keep funding coastal resilience. But I kind of suspect they're not listening to this podcast.
We can always hope.
Yeah. Well, Paul, thank you so much for being on. I think first and foremost, I just really appreciate learning from you and learning from all the work you've done. And you just seem to have a better sense of everything that's going on at NOAA than anyone I know. I can't believe this is the first time I've had you on my podcast. So thank you for joining.
Yeah, thank you, Derek. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Well, my final question that I have to ask, again, because you've had so many different experiences along the coast, is what is your favorite beach or coastal area? Where do you go to rejuvenate and not get stressed about all the incredible work that you have to be doing?
Oh, no, those are two different questions.
Okay, we'll answer them both.
So, well, I can't answer the first one because I actually have never been to a beach or a coastal area that I didn't love. When my kids were growing up, we used to rent beach houses, and we actually moved around the U.S. renting beach houses to go explore different areas. If you ask my wife, she would only be mentioning warm weather beaches. If you ask my kids, they would probably, two of the three would mention the cold weather beaches and areas that we went. But I love them all. They're all so different and so unique, and it's a great opportunity. What I do to recharge, though, is to get outside, and I don't really care what beach it is or what location it is. I like getting outside and just connecting with nature.
I'm not going to let you get off quite that easy. If I gave you a plane ticket right now to one coastal area, where would you go?
Maine, because I haven't actually really explored much in Maine.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. Always a pleasure to talk to you.